And who do you think is teaching that one? Michael Harner and his wife Sandra, that I just told you wrote the book, The Way of the Shaman. Listen to this. The shamanic journey is one of humankind's most ancient visionary, now we're into visualization, visionary methods of entering non-ordinary reality and exploring the hidden universe, usually glimpsed only through myth and dream. Yeah, they will take the myths of the North American Indians, they will take the myths from the Bhagavad Gita, the Ramayana, they will take the myths from occultism, but they will not believe the Word of God. Participants will undergo an experiential initiation into the journey. See, in the shamanic journey, in his mind, the shaman, the witch doctor, goes on a journey either into the future or into the past. He goes on this journey either into the upper world or the nether world to contact a spirit guide, which could be animal or human. And this becomes his guide for life and the channel of power, wisdom and power, through which he operates. It's a demon, of course. Can you believe it? How to get demonized. How to pick up a demon. And this is in our public schools. You've got it here in Florida. You have the quieting reflex. We'll quiet the kids down after they come in from the playground, you know. Or it may be contacting Dusso the dolphin. Little kids in kindergarten are taught to visualize themselves underwater, see this dolphin approaching. Dusso it's called. And focus on it till it becomes vivid and real. Begin a conversation. It will talk back to you. This is shamanism. This is how the witch doctors have always done it. And now that is being taught in our public schools to our little children, and it goes right on up through graduate school. I could name Michael Ray, for example, a professor at Stanford Graduate School of Business, now has passed Harvard as number one, and he is doing the same thing with his candidates for Masters of Business Administration, so forth. The participants will undergo an experiential initiation into the journey, aided by traditional drumming. That's one of the problems among many with rock music. Can you open that briefcase for me over there and get me a, just push those things on the side, and let me get one of my books there. Yeah, just push it out. Should pop up. And there, somewhere, oh, okay, thank you. No, okay, I don't think we have any copies of this. This is called America the Sorcerer's New Apprentice. And I have a chapter in here called Satanism, Rock, and Rebellion. And, I'm quoting here. I mean, this is such a vast topic. I'm sorry. I hope I'm not confusing you. I'm trying to bring things together. I'm quoting Ray Manzarek, keyboard player for The Doors. That was a popular rock group. And listen to what he says. He says, you see, when the Siberian shaman, he knows where it comes from. That's where the word comes from the Tungus tribe in Siberia. When the Siberian shaman gets ready to go into his trance, all the villagers get together and shake rattles and blow whistles and play whatever instruments they have to send him off into this altered state. Okay? There is a constant pounding, 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 and those sessions last for hours. It was the same way with the Doors, that's his rock group, when we played in concert. The concerts didn't last that long, but I think that our drug experiences let us get into it that much quicker. We knew the symptoms of the altered state, so we could try to approximate. It was like Jim Morrison was an electric, you know, he died of a drug overdose and so forth, was an electric shaman. And we were the electric shaman's band pounding away behind him. Sometimes he wouldn't feel like getting into the state, but the band would keep on pounding and pounding, and little by little, it would take him over. God, I could send an electric shock through him with the organ. John could do it with his drum beats. You could see every once in a while twitch. I could hit a chord and make it twitch, and he'd be off. Sometimes it was just incredible, just amazing, and the audience felt it too. Yes, that was part of the job, was to put the audience into the state, and I will come back and explain that in a few minutes. But so, participants back again. These are world leaders. You understand? They're at a world congress to learn how to transform themselves and to bring peace and harmony to this world. And they're getting involved in ancient witchcraft, picking up spirit guides. Participants will undergo an experiential initiation into the journey, aided by traditional drumming and dancing techniques, the whirling dervishes, the occult branch of Islam, designed to achieve the shamanic state of consciousness. Well, I better talk about that at that point. How does this come about? The key, well, another word for the New Age movement is the consciousness revolution. I don't go to movies, but I do make it a point to see some of the important ones. And there was a film some years ago called Altered States. Very accurate. I am astonished. These people know what they're doing. And it was about a scientist who invented an isolation tank. And we have these. Dallas Cowboys have them with a Christian coach. You will find them in gymnasiums. It's a place for the businessmen to relax. And they put you in, they call it a flotation tank, in some places. And you are floating in a heavy Epsom salt solution, and they shut this thing down, and you are totally isolated from sight or sound. You have lost contact with objective reality, with your world. That's the whole purpose. And just your heartbeat and your breathing causes you to make erratic motions, and that flips you into this state of consciousness. There, you could go in a library and you could get a book. I think the title is 200 Ways to Reach an Altered State of Consciousness Without Drugs. Now, the witch doctors have always known that this altered state is the key. Why is that? Let me quote Sir John Eccles, Nobel Prize winner for his research on the brain. Dr. Eccles describes the brain, if you get nothing else, remember this. He describes the brain as, quote, a machine that a ghost can operate, unquote. Okay, now as Christians, we would agree with that. We know that we're not just a lump of protein molecules wired with nerves, a piece of educated beefsteak. Stimulus response mechanism, you know, like behavioristic psychology would try to tell us. But we have a soul and a spirit. There's a ghost in the machine. And Dr. Eccles, you would find some of his tapes, some of his lectures fascinating. He received the Nobel Prize for his research on the brain. And in his research, he wired, I wouldn't know how he does it, but so that he could trace the neural activity through the brain. And he would tell a person to do something that took some thought. And he would follow the neural activity through the brain very quickly, And then he noticed that it always began at a certain location. He called that the SMA, the supplementary motor area of the brain. And then He took people who had Parkinson's or who were paralyzed for some reason or other, who could not do the task that he asked them to do, and he would ask them to do this task. He noticed that the SMA fired normally, but nothing else happened in the brain. And he came to the conclusion that that is where the spirit makes its connection. There's an amazing, I mean, we're spirits living in a body, right? So there somehow is a connection. Psychokinesis, mind over matter, only it's not the kind people try to develop, but it's a connection that God has created in our being. And you are operating your brain and your body. The brain is like a computer. The brain doesn't think, by the way. You think. And you tell the brain what to do. The brain is a means of making a connection with this space-time-matter continuum in which we function. Well, then if the brain is a machine that a ghost can operate, in a normal state of consciousness, you are operating your brain. In an altered state of consciousness, reached under drugs, that's the big thing about LSD. The psychedelics particularly are more powerful. Psilocybin, which is a derivative from peyote, is a derivative from peyote, the cactus bud, which the Native American church is allowed to take by they're granted this right by the government, as Christians take bread and wine. And it puts them in contact with the spirit world, okay? The sacred mushroom. Psilocybin comes from the sacred mushroom. You've probably heard about that or read of scientists experimenting with this sort of thing. In an altered state of consciousness, reached through drugs. Yoga. That's the whole purpose of yoga. Other forms of Eastern meditation, which I said are not contemplation, but tune it out and put you in this altered state. Hypnosis. Practiced by hundreds of so-called Christian psychologists. Practiced by inner healers. Mass forms of hypnosis as they lead people in a highly suggestible state to visualize and go back into the past, and so forth. In an altered state of consciousness, the normal connection between you and your spirit has been loosened. Relaxation, they call it. And you've relaxed it. Alert, but relaxed. And that allows another spirit to interpose itself. Begin to tick off the neurons in your brain, create a universe of illusions. This is where the so-called out-of-body experiences come from, psychedelic experiences. I've interviewed young people around the world who, let's, for example, here are a half a dozen young people, and they have just dropped acid, LSD, as they call it. And suddenly, they are all, six of them, or however many there are, they are all experiencing a common adventure in the same landscape. They're all there together. Now, you cannot explain that away. There is a common source of this delusion. So that's the importance of the altered state of consciousness. It loosens the connection between you and your brain and allows something else to take over. And the witch doctors have always known that, and that's how they make contact with their spirit guide, which is a demon. So that's basically what they're doing. The next one, healing relationships. Next workshop, based on the psychology of A Course in Miracles. A Course in Miracles. My gracious. I thought I had something here. A Course in Miracles was dictated to an atheistic psychologist at Columbia University. I forgot her name, Shukman. What was her first name? Anyway, it doesn't matter. Helen Schuchman, right. And this voice began speaking to her and said, this is a Course in Miracles, take it down. This is a Course in Miracles, take it down. This is a Course in Miracles, take it down. She didn't believe in miracles. She didn't believe in God. She didn't believe in anything. But this voice kept hammering at her. She consulted some of her atheistic psychologist friends at Columbia University, and they said, go ahead, take it down. And so she took the dictation. It ran to 1,100 pages. It's known as A Course in Miracles. It was studied at Robert Schuller's Crystal Cathedral. They had a class studying A Course in Miracles. It's studied in the Pentagon. It's studied in churches around the country. And it is used by psychiatrists in their practice. What it claims is this is Jesus speaking. And he is correcting all the errors that have crept into the Bible. Forgiveness, for example, is simply realizing there is nothing to forgive. Because there is no sin, and you are God. You see how this lie of the serpent of the Garden of Eden, you can be like God. It's a common thread that runs through this. And this happens to be an interview with Gerald Jampolsky, medical doctor, psychiatrist, author of some best-selling books, Love is Letting Go of Fear, Teach Only Love, and so forth. You will find evangelical Christians reading this sort of thing. He tells you how he got into this. Baba Muktananda. Wow, this is just so... I'm sorry. This one thing leads to another. Baba Muktananda... He's dead now. He knows better at this point. But he was one of the most popular gurus. He had meetings for lectures for 6 months in Santa Monica. And he had a special night for the Hollywood stars. 2,600 people showed up. And there was John Denver, Marcia Mason, I mean others that I could name, bowing down, kissing him, acknowledging him as Lord of the Universe. And Baba Muktananda would, well, I see some people who look like they might have been from India or have some background. When an Indian goes like this, Namaste, he says, he is bowing down to the deity in you. And that was one of his teachings, Baba Muktananda. You sit in front of a mirror and you worship yourself because you are God. And God dwells in you as you. Of course, that's a thread that runs through. Carl Rogers. Remember I quoted Bruce Naramore? Who said it was humanistic psychologist Abraham Maslow and Carl Rogers who first taught us this. Carl Rogers was in seminary when he lost his faith and he began to study psychology, and Carl Rogers says, self is God, and you worship at the altar of self. And our problem is we are not true to ourselves. Again, the common thread. But listen to what happened. Well, you've seen the on TV, well, Benny, he knocks him down with his coat, or whatever, they used to just touch him on the forehead. You know what the Hindu calls that? That's called a Shakti pat. If you don't know who Shakti is, Shakti is the goddess. You see her with all these arms, and she's drinking fresh blood out of a skull, and the Hindu says her terror is in her beauty. I'm sorry, her beauty is in her terror. And you see her standing with her heel on Shiva. Now, if there is ever a depiction of Satan in Hinduism, it's Shiva. He is the destroyer. He's one of the Trimurti. They have a trinity, a Trimurti. Shiva, Vishnu, and Brahma, all right? And she has her heel on Shiva. She is, one of her names is Shakti. In Sanskrit, that means force. She is the force, the Star Wars force. Oh, you got a good dose of it in the film Star Wars. the film series Star Wars, it was pure witchcraft. I took Ravi Maharaj, an ex-Hindu guru, because we make it a point just to see what's going on, and I wrote his book, Death of a Guru. Some of you may have read it, and we went to that film when it first came out. We sat there poking one another. Look at that. Look at that. Look at that. This is what they're teaching, deliberately teaching. And when the kids walked out of that theater, one thought remained, may the force be with you. And they had a new concept of God, an impersonal force. Okay? Shakti path, the Hindu calls it a force path. From this force, this basic force of the universe. Well, Muktananda could do it powerfully. He would come up behind you and you didn't even know he was there and touch you with a peacock feather very lightly. Listen to what the man says. This psychiatrist. He touched me with peacock feathers. I began to have an impression that our minds were joined. He touched me again on the head with his hand. After this, beautiful colors appeared all around me, and it seemed as though I had stepped out of my body and was looking down on it. I saw colors whose depth and brilliance were beyond anything I had ever imagined. I began to talk in tongues. A beautiful beam of light came into the room, and I decided at that moment to stop evaluating what was happening and simply be one with the experience, to join it completely. You know what happens when you go with the experience. And that experience does not measure up to what the Bible says. In fact, it's condemned in the Bible. For the next 3 months, my energy level was heightened, and I required very little sleep. I was filled with an awareness of love unlike anything I had known before. Well, how could you complain about that? Love and energy. Doesn't even need to sleep. The power of that experience made me take a new look at everything I was calling real. I had glimpsed a reality not limited to the physical plane. That experience changed my perception of reality. And then he goes on to say, I don't know, how many minutes do we have left here? Oh, okay. He goes on to say how that set him up for, here we are, back on the rabbit trail. That set him up for a Course in Miracles, which he now uses in his psychiatric practice. You are God. Everybody is Jesus Christ. There is no sin, and so forth. It's an incredible satanic delusion that has overtaken our world. And we also want to share how it has come into the church, even among evangelicals. But anyway, at this point, you're probably suffering from information overload already. So we'll take a break and let you recover your thoughts. Well, I hope the documentation that I'm giving you is helpful to you. In other words, I don't want to just make this up. I want to show you where it's happening. Let me just give you the rest of the, what are we doing? I think we're probably going to be okay. Let me just give you the rest of the workshops. These are where the people really get involved, you know. In the practical end. The next one is called Awakening the Heart of a Buddha. Now again, you probably don't know what that means. I hope you don't. Unless you've studied it. And again, I don't suggest that you study. I've seen people be overtaken with disaster from studying this sort of thing. If God has not called you to do it, don't do it. I'll study it for you and explain it to you. In condensed form. I mentioned the Dalai Lama. This is a... the Dalai Lama in Los Angeles. This was from a... oh my goodness, what did I tear that out of? I think I tore it out of New Age Los Angeles. I'm not sure. But I remember it was their December issue. And on the front cover was the Dalai Lama's palace in Lhasa, Tibet. And superimposed over it was his picture. And in large print below, it said, "Peace on Earth." He was being set forth as the Messiah. Those words were uttered by the angels at the birth of Jesus. And this was the Christmas edition, December edition. And I searched through it, and there was not one word about Jesus. Not one word. Now, how is the Dalai Lama bringing peace to this earth? Well, this article is titled, "What Does Kalachakra Have to Do with World Peace?" Only days after the Dalai Lama of Tibet completed his 3-day Kalachakra ritual for world peace with 3,000 people at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium in July, the Los Angeles Times published a grim series of articles about how American military leaders and President Bush were planning for a nuclear war with the Soviet Union, and on it goes. There were several hundred monks in his entourage, and the Dalai Lama taught in Santa Monica that it was possible for all human beings to eventually become a Buddha, a Bodhisattva, a being of the highest wisdom and compassion and power. Tibetan Buddhism takes this ordinary understanding of impermanence, proposes a number of special paths to quickly become a Buddha. But the favorite one of the Dalai Lama, and the one that he was teaching, was called Tibetan Deity Yoga. The tantric method of deity yoga makes it possible for us to be the magician ourselves. That is, the magician who creates reality, and of course they believe that there is no reality, it's an illusion. Some Hindus, for example, would say, Shiva danced himself into a trance, and we're the dream that he's dreaming, and if he wakes up, we're gone. To be able to create the kind of illusion that we would want to live in. So you can be a magician and create the illusion of a world of peace. Deity yoga, therefore, is a special conscious act of creating, visualizing the illusion that we're already perfect beings, already God-like. If we can not only imagine generating that illusion, but can completely be a seemingly permanent illusion, then we would know the procedures to create our own reality. Beings who are developed enough to create their own reality are Buddhas. Well, it goes on and it talks how mandala. This was the mandala, and his monks created a mandala out of sand. And then this mandala was constructed at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles. Can you imagine? And they have a videotape running of the Dalai Lama speaking basically about how we can all become God and create our own universe. I try to get a fundamentalist evangelical sermon in the Natural History Museum in Los Angeles. They wouldn't allow it. I was in Australia being interviewed, and in Wellington, this is New Zealand, Wellington, the capital, by their major newspaper there, and the reporter wanted me to talk about Jimmy Swaggart. It was just after his fall. Wanted me to talk about Jim Baker and so forth, but I pulled out of my briefcase some things about the Dalai Lama, and I said, yes, those men have deceived multitudes, but this man has deceived even more and with a bigger lie. He is running around the world telling all of us that we are God and we just don't know it, and that we can each create our own reality and experience and live it. And I said, you, the media, you guys, you take him seriously. And so do the politicians. And you know what? He was given the Nobel Peace Prize, right? A man who says he's going to bring peace by putting us all into an altered state of consciousness where we then realize that we're God. He wouldn't listen to a word. And he would not report a word of it. It's a delusion. It's a great deception that has overtaken the world, and you can't even reason with these people about it. And it goes into high places. It goes into the church. It goes very much into the Catholic Church, which we may have time to come back and talk about. But I would remind you, you're probably not aware, the first time the Dalai Lama came to the United States, he was the guest of Cardinal Cook in St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, where he spoke to an overflow crowd of about 5,000, and he told them all religions are basically the same, and he received a standing ovation. And Cardinal Cook said, this is the great move of the Spirit in our day. Indeed it is, but not the Holy Spirit. What a deception is sweeping the world. Now you may know that I've got it here somewhere, but I won't take time to shuffle around and try to find it. But you may know that they are planning this summer in Chicago the World Parliament, the Parliament of the World Religions. And I'll have to dig it out during our break and come back and document it for you more thoroughly, because you would find this absolutely astonishing. I'm just trying to give you connections. It's the centenary of the World Parliament, the Parliament of the World Religions that was held in 1893, in Chicago. And it is from that event that most scholars trace the exploding ecumenical movement. And the man who wowed the Congress at that time was a young Hindu monk, unheard of. And was a charismatic speaker. His name was Vivekananda, and he started the Vedanta societies across the Western world. But now the Buddhists, the Hindus, the Muslims, and what reminded me is the Dalai Lama. I believe he gives the opening. In one news clipping it said he gives the opening. Oh no, I looked at their schedule. The opening plenary address. And another one, it said he gives the close, so maybe he gives both the opening and the closing. Mother Teresa will be one of the speakers there. She has already agreed to come. Now, to suggest, it's almost impossible to talk about Mother Teresa. She's just about that far below God. Christians tell me, I watched her on television and she puts my life to shame, you know, the selfless service for humanity and how she's devoted herself and how she helps people, which indeed she does. But unfortunately, Mother Teresa says, my purpose is to draw you closer to God as you conceive Him. If you're a Buddhist, I will help you become a better Buddhist. If you're a Muslim, I help you become a better Muslim. If you're a Hindu, I help you become a better Hindu. She does not know the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's wonderful to put somebody in a clean bed, but it's not so wonderful to launch them from a clean bed into a Christless eternity and not give them the gospel. And yet, even in, in his latest book, his new book, The Body, Chuck Colson praises again Mother Teresa, as has Billy Graham and so forth, many others. By the way, Chuck Colson, and I hope he will, I don't know what the word to use, repent. I hope he will see the light or whatever. He has been granted the latest Templeton Award for progress in religion. You probably saw it in the newspapers. It's worth $1 million. At this point, John Marks Templeton, very successful Wall Street money manager, is the donor of this prize. He wanted to show that religion is the most important thing in the world, and so he makes certain that the Templeton Award for Progress in Religion is worth more than the Nobel prizes. And that prize is determined, the recipients of that prize are determined by a panel of five representatives of the world's five major religions: Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. Would you like to receive a prize awarded by that group? Recipients in the past, Mother Teresa is one of the recipients. Recipients in the past have included leading Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists. Billy Graham was also one of the recipients some years back. And that prize is scheduled, I presume, Chuck Colson must know this. He's been told he has been awarded the prize. He is to be given this prize physically at this World Parliament of the World's Religions in Chicago, to join there with Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, and you can't imagine, occultists of all types. I'm trying to explain that this is the world we live in. And these things begin to influence the church, not just the Catholic Church, the Protestant, the Evangelical, and so forth. And we will get more into that. Well, we've probably gotten enough mileage out of this this poster here of these world leaders. Rituals of Transformation is the next workshop. Alpine Vision Quest, again, going on a vision to be transformed, and so forth. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 3 and just take a look at how this thing began. The more I study the Bible, the more amazed I am. I mean, the Holy Spirit knew exactly what he was saying and has anticipated every lie, every error. For example, Paul says, though I or an angel from heaven, he took care of the angel Moroni of Mormonism, though I or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel. And here you have it laid out. It's astonishing. And you know the story, so we won't go into details. The woman said unto the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God hath said, you shall not eat of it, neither shall ye touch it." Well, he didn't exactly say that, at least we're not told that. "Lest ye die." You tend to exaggerate, and then that gives you an excuse for violating. "And the serpent said unto the woman, ye shall not surely die, for God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof, and did eat, and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat, and the eyes of both were opened, and so forth. Isaiah 14 gives us, well, we won't turn to it, but I just keep looking here at Genesis, but Isaiah 14 gives us, of course, the origin of this serpent, Lucifer, the fall of Lucifer. And it's, again, an astonishing tale. We don't have time to go into it, but it is so instructive. Lucifer expresses five I wills. I will. I will. And one of them is, I will be like the Most High. I will be God. He does away in one stroke with monotheism, one God, and he initiates polytheism, many gods, and we could all be gods. I will be as God. And just to be a little bit facetious, we want to come back and talk a bit about psychology, because it provides an umbrella for all of this thing that I'm talking about here, and I will document that for you. You know Lucifer's problem. He was raised in a dysfunctional family. And he had been abused as a child and so forth. I mean, this is the nonsense that not only is out there in the secular world, but has come into the Christian church. Can you believe it? Excusing. I'm sorry. I may be offending somebody here. And I wish we had time to go into the details. But Lucifer was raised in the very presence of God. Perfection. No sin. And that is where sin began, in his heart. And if you have embraced or accepted an excuse or an explanation for whatever you want to call it, aberrant, antisocial, call it sinful behavior, that does not fit Lucifer, you have been deceived. You don't need to have an explanation for this or that or that. John MacArthur tells of listening to a couple of Christian psychiatrists counseling on the radio across the country. And a lady called in, for example, and she said, a young woman, she said, I have a terrible problem with fornication. I just go to bed with anybody and everybody, and I just can't stop myself. And one of the psychiatrists, Christian psychiatrists, said, well, obviously, you had an overbearing mother and a milquetoast father. And this problem is rooted deeply in your unconscious mind. It comes from traumas you suffered in your childhood. And it is an addiction, and you can't be delivered from it easily. It could take years of therapy. Whatever happened to Jesus, go and sin no more. So we even call murderers, mass murderers, it's not sin, it's sickness. They were mentally ill. And so forth. I remember counseling with a young man. He was abusing his wife physically. And he would tell me, I just can't help it. I mean, that's the way my family was, you know, and they were Christians. And I, every time it happens, I feel so bad and I'm not going to do it again. And then I just can't help it. I said, don't give me this nonsense. You can't help it. If she was a 6'8", 290-pound black belt in karate, I guarantee you wouldn't haul off and hit her. If she was an investor about to put $1 million into your business, you wouldn't haul off and slug her. Don't tell me you can't. It's simply you are not willing to see how evil this is and take responsibility for it. And, of course, he brought this to Eve. And you know, oh God, she was raised in views as a child, didn't get enough toys at Christmas, forced to go to church when she didn't want to, and all this kind of stuff. No, she grew up in the perfect environment of the garden. And that's one of the lies of people who call themselves Christians and say Christ came to redeem us, to restore us to what Adam lost. That's not going to help. Sin began there in that garden. He has something far better than that. But now, what I wanted to point out is there are four basic lies that the serpent presents, and they form the foundation for everything we've been talking about. Now, the first one you won't find explicitly there. It is implied as the foundation for everything that follows. And the first one I believe what is implied is that God is not personal but a force. This voice that talks to you that you think is God, God isn't like that. He doesn't say don't do this and don't do that. But God is a force that permeates everything. And that's the basis of your delusion. The failure to recognize this is the basis of your delusion. Because the next thing you think, the next lie he taught her was there is no death. Which is the first one that's stated explicitly. And basically what he was saying was, you can eat all the other trees of the garden. Why would this tree kill you? It grows out of the same ground. And this force is in everything. It's in all the trees. It's in you.